It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. Now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, it's Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. With me is 93% always is my co-host,
Steven Brown.
And Steven is in a different chair this week because Gene Ha is in his chair.
Yes, yes. Welcome, Gene Ha.
I get the high chair with the you little tray on it and everything. It's wonderful.
Yeah, the fancy one.
You get the comfortable chair.
It's actually a leather armchair, which is big enough so that I sit all the way back. My feet are off the ground. I feel like a kid.
Yeah, that's how I always feel.
It also reclines.
Oh, wow.
So if you get really bored by this discussion, you can just lean back
and take
a nap.
And, right.
Steven won't even notice. He'll just complain about DC movies, and that'll be an hour.
We can fill an hour with that.
Oh, yeah. He works in a comic shop. He can just rant about comics nonstop.
Yeah, I can just repeat the this week's spiels.
That's why he has a podcast.
Right.
We actually created this podcast on the floor of C2E2 because Steven's booth, Chimera's Comics, were there. And he took a break, and we were walking the floor and complaining about everything. And we had Frappuccinos in our hands, and it was like, this is it.
Well, we were complaining about things until we saw the original John Byrne pencils for that Fantastic Four issue.
Yeah, there was a dealer was selling an entire issue, and this was before the artist edition came out. And then we got really excited about that,
right?
And we were yelling just as much. So what we really need to do is invite Gene Ha over to the podcast and talk about ourselves for a good hour.
Right.
And then ask him if he likes us.
Right.
But Gene has a new book, May, which had a really successful Kickstarter.
Yes.
And is out now. And if you don't know, Gene has done a lot of work for Marvel and DC.
As of the time of this broadcast, May number 3 from Dark Horse just came out this week. I don't know how long it'll take for you to like edit out all my ums and ahs and stuff like that and get this on the air.
I'm not going to do any of that.
Oh, I'm in trouble.
This comes out, it comes out as is.
You'll be lucky if I don't hit publish when we start recording.
What about my cuss words? Oh, man.
Well, we do carry an explicit warning on our podcast because...
Because Steven drops the F-bomb about things
I just can't,
that aren't really worth
it. I'm very enthusiastic about what we talk about. May is actually selling really well. We got the graphic novel from the Kickstarter. That would be back in... We didn't have it in like November?
It came out... You probably received it around September, early September sometime.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and it actually sells really good. We've put it at all three of our stores. We have since sold out at some of the stores, and then we've actually had to do several restocks. So it's awesome. It's doing really good.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's we ordered from Diamond, the monthly book. It's kind of... There is a weird vacuum in kids' books where it's either stuff is so dumbed down or just adapted from cartoons. Those are my two favorite books right now to recommend is for young girls especially is May and Molly Danger.
Right, and we've had Jamal on when Jamal was raising the money for Molly Danger.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it seems like you and Jamal and creators like you are starting to finally make this turn of recognizing that girls, if they don't already like comics, they can like comics.
Yes.
And it not being objectified. But where did the idea first come to you for May?
The characters came first before the setting, and I really, really swiped a lot of, personality for the girls from, Why I Hate Saturn by Kyle Baker.
Ah, that's a great book.
Yeah. It's wonderful. It's not kid friendly.
Yeah. Kyle Baker's stuff, it can be very, deceptive in that way.
Yeah. It's not actually obscene, but it's about adults living in New York and dealing with things like their sex lives and dating and stuff like that. And, getting really, really drunk, which apparently you're not supposed to let the characters do inside of a kid-friendly book, so.
Oh, that's frowned upon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Kyle Baker's work was amazing. Have you ever seen his Plastic Man run?
Yeah.
It
didn't do well. I remember an interview with Kyle Baker, where he was doing the Plastic Man book, and he was doing it for kids. And I don't know. I don't particularly like Plastic Man, but it was a neat book.
I love Plastic Man.
Well, but I guess...
Oh, we had this argument yesterday where you chose Elongated Man over Plastic Man.
Yes, absolutely. And I will forever always stand by that decision.
Okay. It's like choosing Zeppo over Chico.
No, I don't know what that means, but...
It means you're wrong. That's what it means.
Elongated Man is like a detective and a stretchy guy. Plastic Man is just a stretchy guy.
Okay, the way I take it is that choosing Elastic Man over Plastic Man is like choosing the Robert Downey Jr. Chaplin over Charlie Chaplin himself.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
All right, well, because Plastic Man was first?
Yes.
But he doesn't do anything except stretch. That's it.
He turns into things.
Sure, but so can Elongated Man.
But Elongated Man never does.
Okay, Charlie Chaplin is about pure cinema. He's a great cinematographer. He's an important figure in the history of film. And he made films.
Right.
Charlie Chaplin was the movie about Chaplin with Robert Downey Jr. happened to be a movie about a person, but it wasn't a grand moment of history. I mean, Plastic Man was about literally stretching what the comics form could do.
Yeah.
And that's part of why it's important. Elastic Man is an interesting story about a detective who happens to have some powers that were swiped from Plastic Man.
Yeah. I could almost forgive you if you went Reed Richards because Reed Richards is basically Plastic Man with a completely different personality of like, let's make the stretchy guy the boring guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost see that, but Elongated Man's like, let's make the stretchy guy nothing.
Yeah. Well, okay. Take this concept and think about what it means for comics. Plastic Man liked to disguise himself as random objects inside of the world, hiding from criminals, but they'd always have his stripes and colors and all that on him and the weird goggles in some weird shape.
Right.
And at a certain point in the comic, he began carrying paint with him so he could paint random objects to look like himself. And then the criminals would try killing a fire hydrant.
And I'll give it, that's great, having never read Plastic Man outside of Justice League.
You should read the original stuff. The Golden Age stuff is really brilliant because it's almost a comedy book. And it's very much in that kind of Will Eisner.
Yeah, and it was pushing things. It was really interesting. And anyway, there are some great Elastic Man stories, but it's just that it's the same way like Chaplin movies are silent movies mostly.
Right.
So they're very dated, but they're really, really important. That's the thing about it.
Yeah, it's like a stepping stone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're wrong.
I'm just saying, if I'm going to pick the lineup for the Justice League, I'm still going to grab Elongated Man before Plastic Man.
Still makes me
He's friends with the Flash. I think that's...
Everyone's friends with the Flash. The Flash is very friendly.
I can agree with that in the sense that you want to make a Justice League team that writers know what to do with.
Yeah.
And writers have very little idea how to take a boundary-stretching, conceptual stretching guy as opposed to a detective-stretching guy and adding them to a team.
Right. I'll give you that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so what you said just made perfect sense.
Yeah.
Does your Justice League have Batman?
Yeah.
You don't need another detective.
Nah, what if Batman's on another mission?
Then why? Then he's not on your Justice League.
No, but Elastic Man is a really good Robin for almost any other character.
Yeah, there you go.
He's got a sense of humor. You can talk things over with him. He has a good point of view. He'll bring up insights and have investigated stuff that other people were too busy to do. And just like, oh, who owns this car? Oh, while everyone else was actually being the main characters of this team book, I was off investigating who the car was. So here's all the facts. We don't have to spend more than a single panel investigating it.
Yeah. And again, has almost no panel time.
Right.
Yeah. I was off page the
entire
time. He's
one of those guys when they do the group shot of the Justice League in the book, they forget to draw him in that group shot. You know,
yeah. I think that's a great discussion, Gene, is that he's the sidekick, because in his own stories he's the sidekick to his wife, has no powers at all.
Right.
But going back to your book. Yeah. Right. So when you started the Kickstarter, were you intending to self-publish it first?
I definitely wanted to. I did not want to start publishing myself in the sense of on an ongoing basis publishing my book, distributing it through Diamond and other distributors and all that type of stuff, because being the lone guy trying to negotiate with Diamond or some other or a publishing house is a nightmare. I mean, as a comic shop, you know that it's a little hard to deal with them if there's a problem or something like that. And being the publisher of a single book when they're trying to make sure that everyone's getting their copy of their DC books and their Marvel books on time, they're not so worried about you. I mean, it's fair, but... I don't want to be in that position.
So when did Dark Horse get involved?
They were very interested in the Kickstarter campaign, and then things got kind of finalized before the Kickstarter campaign had even finished. Because they just said, we want to be part of this.
Oh, awesome. Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting now. I'm starting to see more and more indications of people creating the content with Kickstarter, but then a major distributor comes in. We just saw that with Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they raised $6 million to do 14 episodes, which everyone assumed they were going to put on their website and maybe create a subscription model. And then during San Diego, Netflix just decided, okay, we have it.
Yeah.
You know, and which my first thought was, well, why didn't Netflix pay for it?
Right.
But I think it is these distributors are seeing if the interest is there.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you've had, say, 1,500 people commit to a Kickstarter, those are 1,500 sales.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly. We've looked into it, too. And, Gene, you might know, there's a certain number you have to have guaranteed sales for Diamond to even carry your book in the previews.
Wow.
So you have to kind of guarantee ahead of time, this many is guaranteed sold, and then Diamond will be like, okay, we'll list you in Diamond. And that might have changed, or that might not be 1,000% accurate.
Yeah, well,
but
back in the 90s, they didn't have that, so that's more of a new thing.
Yeah.
I had a book that sold 600 copies, and Diamond picked it up.
Right, and they put it in there.
I was going to say, I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that might be, like I said, this was something that me and Carm looked at, like, years ago, when we were like, we're going to get our book in Diamond. And it's like, well, what's the first step to that? And we looked into it, and it just seemed like astronomically difficult. And I think, to your point, I think about as far as a Diamond, I couldn't imagine having a Diamond rep. We have like a specific guy to talk to for sales and all this stuff, but being the thousands of items that are in Diamond and the range of like different companies like Marvel all the way down to like Funko Pop and the t-shirts, graffiti designs and all this stuff, it's like the publishing guys, there's so many indie guys in Diamond, it's like, yeah, I think it is. It's a lot nicer that Dark Horse, a company like Dark Horse, can see that people are super interested in your book and like, all right, we'll carry it. And it just smooth lines everything.
Well, as a retailer, when you do the monthly order, how far do you get into the indie books in previews every month?
Right. And I do go through previews every month, like page by page, because you want to make sure you don't miss something that would appeal. Like a good example is Stephen King's kid. Can't remember his
Stephen
name.
Oh, Prince.
Joe Hill.
Yeah. He does a lot of indie books and his stuff always sells. So he's one of those guys where sight unseen, if he's writing it, we get a couple shelf copies because I for sure will be able to sell it. You know, it's the same thing. You do kind of have to go through all the indie books to make sure nothing like slips under the radar. You know, it's like, I've got a lot of guys, like there's two books out, Archangel and Renata Jones, 1% or something like this, indie books where they looked like books that would sell. Do you know? And it's like really hard to kind of argue that, like what'll sell and what won't. But yeah, I mean, we go through previews page by page just because you don't want anything to like slip under the radar. You know?
But I wouldn't say every comic shop owner does that.
No, yeah. And certainly, I don't know, I'm just speaking from my own experience, we don't have the room to carry all the comics that are being published. We carry 98% of every comic Marvel and DC published. I get like no shelf copies of Dr. Fate. It's a good book, but no one reads it. I get one for my subscribers and that's it.
Wow.
You know, but it's like, but the indie books, certainly we're carrying probably 30% of all the indie titles that are out there just because there's so many, you know, just because it's limited shelf room.
Right. And,
you know,
and with something like Dark Horse is not really considered an indie. Dark Horse is kind of like a third party candidate in a two party system.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Well known.
Yeah.
But not one of the big two.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, that's interesting. Like I said, it's a book where we've split it at times in the store where we get enough shelf copies for the kids section and the indie section, because there is the overlap between, it's kind of like what I was saying earlier, a lot of the kids' books kind of seem dumbed down, where you can't really read kids' books. I don't read the Avengers cartoon adaptation kids' book,
right.
But I'll read Molly Danger, I'll read May. It's like there's books that they speak to children, and I think they also speak to like adults because they're not dumbed down.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's an element where to make a good kids' book that an adult can read, you have to have one story you're telling to kids, and a totally different story you're telling to adults, and they both have to happen seamlessly at the same time.
And are they sometimes the same plot with just different themes running around, or is it like your A story and your B story?
It's the thing is that you have flashy fun events happening, which are connected by the plot, but they're flashy fun events just on their own. They're fun to read, mm-hmm. And then you have the connected plot, where if you think about it for a second, you realize, oh, there's not just things exploding and people punching each other going on. There's a reason why it's going on. There's a reason why this person looks heroic, but it actually they turn out to be either a fool or a villain. And this person looks like they're the sidekick, but they're actually the, I'm literally describing May right now. This person looks like the sidekick, but she's actually the main character of the book because she's the one who's making the big decisions and making things happen.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of that in things like Avatar. The Nickelodeon series was like that, where it was very kid friendly, but there were a lot of adults into it because it would have these large season arcs and these huge story arcs, which created this whole deep mythology.
Yeah, but there's always something silly and fun happening every episode.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's still fun and engaging for kids. And then and I think that's another layer of it where it's Avatar is a good example, I think, where that's a show where you can watch as a kid and be like, oh, it's fun. There's all this stuff going on. You know, it's funny. And then you get older and then you're interested more in like the depth and the mythology of the characters. And it's like, okay, well, what are the motivations for this character? And it goes a little higher than just Batman Brave and the Bold, where it's a great show, but it's basically a kid's.
But even Batman Brave and the Bold had that other layer. It wasn't a very deep layer, but the other layer was like, weren't Silver Age comics really goofy?
Right.
You know, whereas my sons would like, they probably assumed the show created Bwana Beast.
Right.
You know, or composite Superman.
Right.
But as an old time fan, as an adult, you're like, oh, I remember that issue. And look at the way comics have changed.
Right.
So even a show like that will have two layers. It's like when little kids watch The Simpsons.
Yeah. Now, if I can go on to like how sometimes the sequels of kids or kid friendly material can then just go totally off course. Both the sequels to Avatar, Legend of Korra, the first season at least. And also we were talking about this before the radio. We started recording the Star Wars prequels. Both try to get deeper and then just stopped having anything interesting happen on screen. So you end up with like a long meeting of the Galactic Senate where it's just like, now with the party of planet blah, 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 like to speak. Yes, we will. And we are really, really dull. First season of Legend of Korra, it was just kind of like way too much, kind of like just people sitting around discussing things when it's like, this isn't even good cinema. I mean,
My son loved Avatar, and then when Korra started, we got really excited. He dropped right off. I stayed with it, and it got really great at the end.
Oh,
season 3 and 4 were great. I couldn't get him to come back.
Yeah, and you don't want to go through that kind of lull of like, and also this happened inside of the Matrix movies, where it's kind of like, yeah, we're going to spend 5 to 10 minutes just discussing what are the feelings of air conditioners, and we're not even going to have like moving parts for air conditioners. We're just going to sit over this vent and discuss this box we're pointing at for like 5 or 10 minutes.
Well, what do you think that is? Do you think it's because they've created this universe and now they want to explore it? Or is it because they think, well, it's been a couple of years now, our audience is older? Because J.K. Rowling was able to do that with Harry Potter, where those first books are for 10-year-olds and those last few books are for 16-year-olds.
The thing is, you can do so much with... What I really put it down to is you have to trust the intelligence of the reader to understand the subtext, to understand what's going on behind the main action. And you don't have to show the Galactic Senate to say that something happened in the Galactic Senate. You can have something interesting happening and then someone mentioning, oh my God, those idiots in the Galactic Senate just passed such and such law. And it's like, what are they, crazy?
That's what you have in the original Star Wars.
Yeah.
How the Emperor maintain control without the bureaucracy?
Yeah,
and then Phantom Menace is 10 minutes of bureaucracy.
Yeah, it's like... Right. We don't trust the viewers to believe the Galactic Senate exists and that they make laws. Let's get a 20-minute section of some movie where they're just sitting around watching people float on platforms to get up to the speaker's dais. And it's like...
Because somebody really wanted to design what the Galactic Senate looked like. Yeah. And look, the circular things move.
But he didn't trust the viewers to understand, if he just kind of telegraphed what's happening, to fill in the blanks. That's all he had to do. But instead it was kind of like, no, we need to show that these guys, you know, what the politicians do. And it's just like, oh, you don't need to do it. This isn't good cinema.
Yeah, it's like too heavy-handed almost, where they have a hard time walking that line of what's too much to show that now you've gone overboard and you kind of beat the viewer over the head with. Do you get the point that I'm driving home? It's like, it's almost too much.
If I can do kind of like a pop culture reference right now. essentially, if you ever wonder what some women are talking about when they talk about mansplaining,
yeah,
George Lucas was Lucasplaining to us.
Right. that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, he thought we were idiots.
But I think Harry Potter's a good example, because I think that's a book series that's kind of designed to, you're supposed to grow up with those books. So I think it's, they're all out now, so I think people just, if you're getting really into them, you just fly through all the books. But I think when they were coming out, I read that first book in like, 1999 or 2000. But then you'd wait, all right, another year, 2 years, and the next book would come out. Harry's a little older, I'm a little older. It's like you kind of grew up with those characters. And I think that that's a series that kind of lends itself to, you can grow up with the characters because it's something that's gone on for, you know, over a decade.
Right. And my oldest...
He's a time traveler. I really did read it in 1982.
I took it back with me.
That and Tron.
Right.
Yeah, my son's 9, and he really liked Harry Potter, but we've never finished the last one. We haven't read any of them yet, but we've never finished the last movie together because it's gone past him.
Yeah.
And then I realized, all right, it's going to take a few years for him to go past. But for May, what is the target age you're going for? As you said, you're trying to go more kid friendly.
See, I literally don't have a target age. I mean, I literally want the book to be visually fun enough so that you can hand it to a 9-year-old and they will have fun looking at two girls running around, jumping across rooftops in a city while a giant cat is chasing them or something like that, right? On the other hand, if I hand it to like a 45-year-old and I've handed off to both and it's not been a problem, there's going to be a level of moral and social complexity of the interaction between the sisters and the society they're dealing with, where it's like, oh, I recognize this and these are feelings I have as an adult trying to deal with a world where things don't make sense. And they can enjoy the people bouncing around while cats are chasing them, giant cats are chasing them thing. But they can. I also want to have kind of an emotional level where it, all of that rings true to you no matter how old you are. I'm not really aiming at like, say, 8-year-olds. Right. But I want to have something a bit in there where if you're an adult, the kid in you is still going to enjoy the flashy fun bits in the same way that, you know, at this point, I can still go to a 1940s Warner Brothers cartoon.
Right.
And it is a miracle of storytelling where if you put it in front of a 5-year-old, they're just going to be laughing their heads off. And you put it in front of a 60-year-old and they'll be laughing their heads off at totally different moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's such a beautiful craft to those. And it said, I was listening to another podcast. I was listening to Joe Dante on Marc Maron. And you know, he did a couple of the later Looney Tunes, like the one with Steve Martin. And I think he did the one with Michael Jordan. And he was saying how they didn't do that well at the box office because he said kids don't really know these characters anymore.
Yeah.
And you have Cartoon Network trying to reboot it every few years. I really enjoyed the last series. I think it was just, it's always called Looney Tunes, but the last year was called The Looney Tunes Show, and it was really dry and it was really kind of sedate, and it was Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck living in a house, and like Daffy Duck was freeloading over Bugs Bunny, and the characters were really true to themselves.
I didn't watch that. They tried to turn into a reality show.
A little bit, but it's more of a sitcom.
Okay.
So Yosemite Sam lived down the street. But to hear Joe Dante say that these characters don't resonate now shocked me. Because that is something that seems timeless, but it's kind of more of the dispersal of media. It's like, I'm like, but isn't Looney Tunes on every day? And then I realized, well, it's on Boomerang, which is, you know, hundreds of channels up. And my kids are watching Cartoon Network, but they're watching Amazing World of Gumball and Teen Titans Go.
This is something that drives me crazy, where people take a classic property and say, oh, it's because of these problems with the classic property that audiences don't connect with it. It's the fault of the property. When, you know, generations have loved such and such, you know, Alice in Wonderland or Marvel characters or whatever. And in the 90s, people just said, well, it's just in the nature of Marvel Comics. Audiences can't connect with these characters and their stories are all tied together and it's too complex. And you'll never be able to take something like an Avengers story and make it make sense to audiences. This was the argument everyone had, every comic geek had just about in the 90s of just, you can't do this. It won't make sense. The X-Men, yeah, that makes some sense because you don't need to explain separate origins. They all have one origin. They're all mutants. It makes sense. You can make a movie series about that. But the Avengers is just too dumb. You can't do it. It's too geeky. And now people are making these arguments about how you can't make a good Superman movie. It's in the nature of the Superman character that you can't connect with audiences today. And it's kind of like, yeah, in both cases, it's just you put the wrong creative team in charge.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point because it has kind of flipped. Like you said, in the 90s, no one would have made an Avengers movie.
Well, that's why Marvel had the rights to Avengers, because nobody wanted to make an Avengers movie.
Yeah.
They wanted to make Spider-Man and X-Men, and they sold those.
And I think we've talked, I mean, ad nauseum, we've kind of taken a dump on the Superman movies recently, but it is a movie where it's like, if you like superhero movies, watch that first Superman movie. It's that good, that Christopher Reeve.
It's a great movie today.
You know, there's hokey stuff in it, and there's some goofy moments in it. It's a little campy, but not as campy as something like Batman 66 was. But it's like you're absolutely right. I think it's the culture's kind of flipped where it's like now they're like, well, you can't make Superman. He's too goody two shoes.
And they tried to make Superman Batman in the last couple of movies,
yeah,
and no one likes
it. And it doesn't work. And I think that's what's really interesting is like, yeah, and then 20 years ago, they were like, well, you can't do Avengers because how do you explain other origins? And it's like, well, they did that.
I had a friend in 2008 when it was coming out who was telling me that Iron Man was not going to do well.
Yeah.
And I said, why? He goes, because nobody knows who he is. I was like, man builds robot suit. Done.
Yeah.
That's all you need. And that's what they did.
Yeah.
And then they were able to build everything on top of that. And you do need to strip these characters down to what makes them work. And sometimes, look at Captain America. Captain America was created in the 40s, and they brought him back in the 60s, and you would imagine he wouldn't have worked, like, at a time when Vietnam was about to explode.
Yeah.
You know, a character from World War II wouldn't work at all. And he was more popular in the Marvel Age than he was in the Golden Age.
Yeah.
You know, because there's something about a character which resonates with people, and if you go back to what that is, you know, but it's also one of the reasons I love Batman so much, because there have been completely opposite versions of Batman which have worked.
Yeah, it's one of those. I think he's probably the most flexible comic book character, because we've talked about this, I think, before. You put Batman on the moon in the Watchtower and it works. You put Batman in another dimension with the Justice League and it works. Put Spider-Man in space. And it's like, what is Spider-Man doing outside of New York? He's such a character of that city. It doesn't really work when you put him anywhere. He can go to Paris and do a story, but he's always kind of got to go to back to New York. Batman can, like, get in his Bat rocket ship and have, like, those goofy 1950s adventures out in space, and it kind of works.
Yeah, you can put him in any genre. You can do a comedy Batman. You can do a horror Batman. You could do a noir Batman. You could do a realistic slice of life Batman. You could do a detective story.
Yeah.
He's kind of like, he's the one superhero that fits in every genre.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that was that nobody else has that alchemy.
Yeah, I mean, say what you're saying in a different way. You can do a successful Christopher Nolan Batman, and you can do a successful Lego Batman, and you can watch one after the other, and it will not make your brain bend. It all fits together.
Yeah, it just works.
Yeah, and you did a Batman graphic novel, Fortunate Son, which was very realistic and very illustrative, which is completely different than some of the other takes.
Yeah. It's just, there's so... He's an amazing character. He is. You're right. He's flexible in a way that a character like Spider-Man or even Superman is not that flexible.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say, going back to your version of Batman, would you say that was the way you would do Batman, or if you did him today because he's flexible, you could do him in a completely different way?
Oh, see, I mean, when you ask me how I would handle Batman, you have to figure out, first of all, what media you're going to do it in. If I was going to do them in comics, we'll assume that, because why would they hire me for anything else? And then the thing is, essentially everybody who goes to a comic convention, even if they don't read superhero comics, has their pitch on how they would handle Batman, specifically Batman. And some of these people then go on to become the top writer in comics for a month or for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get their chance to do their version of Batman. I mean, you know, the Grant Morrison Batman is totally different than, say, the Neil Gaiman or going other writers, Alan Moore Batman.
Right.
I mean, you know, he just reveled in the fact that, you know, I'm going to have my grim and gritty Batman meet a goofy space Batman. If you ask me what my version of Batman is, essentially it's trying to figure out, wow, where can I expand on the imaginative space of Batman that somebody else hasn't already done 1,000 times better than my version? If you ask me, like, how would I handle Elastic Man or something, or how would I handle Plastic Man, suddenly it's like, oh, well, they have not been so overtrodden so much. There's some fresh ground there where I can really play with it.
Well, that's almost where the flexibility is a negative, because there's been so many versions that the bandwidth has been eaten up.
Yeah, he's been done so well by so many people.
Yeah, where if you did the Hulk, there's Only a couple of Hulks.
Right.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean,
well, there's Gray and Smart.
Oh, but I mean, there's just been so many plays on the, like, of course, the original Hulk was just this dumb, angry guy. With, you know, with the heckle and jive. I'm sorry, that's a song by what's it? I can't remember the name of the band, the Australian band.
Is that Men at Work?
Men at Work.
That is Men at Work.
But anyway, you know, the split personality thing with one dumb, one smart, and then later on they did things like there's a smart Hulk, there is the there's Hulk and Banner as two separate bodies, and they've played around with the idea of duality so much with him. There's been a lot of really brilliant work playing around with it. Now there's Hulk, who's neither traditional Hulk or Banner. It's just two different personalities of a different person who's still Hulk.
Yeah, yeah. The Amadeus Cho Hulk the new one. And I think Darwin Cook might have mentioned it in an interview for The New Frontier when he was trying to figure out, he wanted to kind of do a Justice League story. And Mark Waid had already done Year One, which was awesome.
That's a great
and,
book.
And I think, who did that JSA story where all the superheroes are forced to retire by the government? That might have been James Robinson, right?
Yeah.
So he kind of like, okay, well, in the middle of that story in Mark Waid's Year One, there was like kind of this perfect sliver for him to do like the early days of the Justice League before they really technically formed. And that's the same problem of... when you do kind of coming to a character like Plastic Man or Elongated Man, it might be a lot easier because there's less iconic material being done. Yeah. Batman's iconic. Every 3 years, it's iconic. Jim Lee's Hush was iconic.
Yeah.
Well, Snyder's run was iconic.
Now, let me bring up something here. Now, comics is a really amazing creative space also because almost everyone who works on a character has an obsessive knowledge of the history of that character.
Yes.
Even if they've... actually, didn't really read that much, but they need to get up to speed first. They're going to, you know, nowadays, a writer who's being put onto a property they've never written before and never read much of before will just beg the fans for what are the most important stories I need to read before I start writing this.
Yeah.
They're very, very well researched. Now, if I was going to do something where I was going to try to tread new ground and do something really different with a character, I'd go for something where you don't have comic geeks dominating how the stories are told. Where you have research and story incompetence telling story after story about this character.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't that lead you to a creator-owned book then?
No. Well, yes, that also. But if I was going to reinterpret a character, which is not, then wouldn't be a creator-owned book, I would go for Frankenstein. Because the original novel is so brilliant and so deep. And a game writer, Ken Haidt, recently just told me some stuff about like the history of the character where it's like, okay, I thought I knew a lot, and you are telling me things I had no idea about. But the original character and the original story were very complex. And Dr. Frankenstein himself is an unreliable narrator. The guy is an amoral sociopath.
Yeah.
Who's totally unafraid to lie. And he lies to people in the story and says, but then I had to. You understand this as, you know, the people I'm writing to, that I had to lie at this point. And it's kind of like, yeah, we understand you're lying to us right now. That when you say, oh, yeah, I'm actually a good man. Yeah, it's you abandoned a child. You made a giant child and you abandoned it. How are we supposed to believe you're a good person? But I am. And it's kind of like, oh, there's so much to explore here. And if you realize, if you take it as given that he's an unreliable narrator, and you realize, now, we know he's a sociopath from the fact that he abandoned a giant child. He took this giant child and just threw it in the woods and said, hope you die.
Yeah.
Right.
If you take that as a given and you look at all the other things that happen and say, oh, he's claiming here that this is the only thing he could do. And this monster kept on warning him, I'm really angry at you for abandoning me in the woods. I'm going to kill your wife. And he's like, ha, 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 that's great. And then he killed your wife. And it's kind of like, okay. And then you say you're surprised at the time this happened. I'm going to have to interpret the story a little differently. There's so many things I could explore with that.
What do they call it? The unreliable narrator, writing?
He's an unreliable narrator.
But the interesting thing...
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Just going back. And this is not a problem in comics because you don't have these incompetent Hollywood guys who don't do their research.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everyone in comics who does DC or Marvel work does their research.
Yeah, well, they're all fans. You know, it's like everyone working in comics now are, I assume, fans of comics. It's not like 60 years ago where... Jack Kirby or John Buscema is a great example. He hated Avengers. Yeah. He thought Spider-Man was a dumb character.
He only liked drawing Conan.
Right, but it was a paycheck for the guy. And he turned out some of the best work in comics, but it's like a lot of those original guys, it was a paycheck because they couldn't afford to be architects or they couldn't be afford to get
they didn't get comic strips, which is where all the money was.
Right, there. Right. You know, but now it's like they're all fans, so there is that level of research being done. And I could be wrong. Maybe they don't do it anymore, but I was under the impression if you were given a book like Avengers and you hadn't, and maybe this is before like the billion-dollar movie days, and you hadn't read it, Marvel would be like, all right, here's your research materials, and would give you like maybe, I don't know, what comics or maybe like the Marvel guide to the, you know, the what do they call those handbooks?
That's interesting because going back to the days for you, Gene, when Marvel was so continuity heavy, you did the Further Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix and Ascani-san, which were two series that were made to tie a lot of continuity together. So what kind of reference materials did you get when you started on those?
This was mostly pre-internet age when I was doing it. So I had read a lot of X-Men as a kid, but a lot of stuff had happened between me stopping reading X-Men around the time I entered high school and me graduating from college in those roughly 8 years. So my research was going to my local comic shop and just asking fellow customers and the comic shop owners, what the heck is going on here? And this old woman here is the clone, is the daughter of the clone. Oh, okay, I know her. Yeah, she's the daughter of the clone of Phoenix. And this guy here is the clone of the baby of the clone of Phoenix. And it's just like, okay, I'm starting to get this. And the two main characters are on their honeymoon. I know who those two are, and they're both the real versions, right? Yes. And
right. And yeah, that's kind of like exactly as convoluted and complicated that sound to explain to people who don't read comic books. That's how crazy it is. Like, I've explained to my roommate, like, I said, oh, Mantis is going to be in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and she's like, who's Mantis? And it's like, all right, a Vietnamese plant creature person who was married to the spirit of the swordsman, but was also the celestial Madonna that Kang chased around through time and is now in space and is the Guardians of the Galaxy. And yeah, go.
And that's I should add this in because I know there's going to be some people who know the continuity better than me. When I was explaining Cyclops and Phoenix, also Rachel has some alternate universe DNA inside of her history too, and if I leave that out, somebody's going to jump on me for it.
On Twitter, somebody's going to be very angry.
Yeah, that was a really weird period of X-Men to not be there, because even as a fan, I left in like the late 80s. I completely missed Jim Lee, so I left around the time Silvestri was drawing, and they were in Australia fighting cyborgs,
and they were all like, the world thought they were all dead,
and I was like, I've had enough of this. And at that point, Frank Miller was doing Batman, and I gravitated over to DC, and I came back around the time you were doing Cyclops and Phoenix, because the animated series had started, and everybody was talking about how great it was, and it took me a year to figure out who like Gambit and Cable and Bishop were, and then trying to piece that together, because I can't think of any other book where this happened. But the more complicated that book got, the more popular it got for a while, and to the point where it would absorb your entire budget and you had no money left over to buy anything else.
Yeah, we've said at the store before, it sometimes feels like, not so much anymore because they've canceled half the titles, but it's especially in the 90s, I'd say, is there was DC, there was Marvel, and there was X-Men. It was like there were enough X-Men books to be its own continuity, because the crossover events happened in a vacuum for the most part, unless it was like Age of Apocalypse or Onslaught, some of the bigger ones. And especially like in the 2000s, it just seemed like every year there was the Marvel crossover and there was two or three big X-Men crossovers. And if you missed one, good luck trying to figure out what was going on, you know?
Yeah, because they would always kill somebody in it.
Right.
But that goes back to what you're saying about casual fans. And I think we're getting to that point with the X-Men movies, where Apocalypse was basically all about the continuity of their movies. And it seems like it's always this arc of, as we were saying before, you strip the character down to what resonates, but each story you do adds another layer on top of that character. And then you get to the point where you're doing stories about stories. And so the only thing that resonates to the people is the people that have read the first story.
Yeah.
And then when somebody new comes in and, you know, back in the day, you would open a comic and it would be full of asterisks. You know, now they there's a cover page and they expect you to go to the internet.
Right. Yeah, they wildly do away with the asterisks every once in a while. Yeah. It seems like the only book I think they really do it in is the Amazing Spider-Man Monthly, because Dan Slott's referencing his own stuff.
And he's been on it so long.
He's been on it for years, so it kind of works. But yeah, it's like I don't really know any other book I read that they really do the asterisks, like old 70s comics, you know, or 80s stuff, and 90s especially. Right. You know, where it's like, read this Iron Man, because then this story of Avengers, they're talking about this thing Hercules did, and, you know, it's all over the place.
Yeah. Well, and this brings up, like, the reason why the most successful X-Men movie, I think, of all time was Deadpool.
Yeah.
Because it respected the continuity and the references and all that type of stuff. But you didn't need to know it all to enjoy the story.
No, it wasn't about the continuity.
Yeah.
And now, May, as you were saying before the show started, you're wrapping up the fourth issue now. Are you planning this to be an ongoing with no end in sight, or do you...
I've always been planning to do it as a series of series. So a bit like how they handle, say, Hellboy or Mouse Guard or things like that.
Yeah, oh, nice. Hellboy's just wrapped up.
Yeah. So if I can go on a run like that, I'll be very happy. Yeah. There's the first six issues will form a really, really nice kind of emotional unity. I'm not going to tie up all the plot threads at all, but there's going to be a nice sixth issue with the guest artist where she kind of, we have a flashback and it explains why all this stuff happened and what it means to all the characters.
So now, if say you're continuing May for 6-7 years to our point, how do you get to a point where you don't get in that corner where you're telling, as you said, you're not going to wrap up all the plot threads about six? Do you think you'll be able to avoid at a point not telling stories about the stories you just told before?
Here's the thing. I think if you can always tell a clear story where you understand what the stakes are to the character, you don't have... Don't slow down to explain the plot. Just make it clear that why the character cares, what they're fighting for, what's in their way, and you can tell a really good story about that. You don't have to explain all the details. In the grand imagination of George Lucas as a young man when he started Star Wars, he was starting in the middle of a grand adventure story, and he never slowed down the plot to explain all the backstory. They just mentioned there was something called the Clone Wars and that so-and-so's father was a great pilot who, there is a Galactic Senate and that stuff like that, but he did not slow down to explain how the Galactic Senate works or how you do a procedure in the Galactic Senate or, jumping to a different franchise, what is the philosophy of a mouse droid, you know?
Right.
These are not important to the emotional core of the story and why we're interested in it. It's fun afterwards, after we care, to explain what all the details are, or even, this is very important, to create a space where the fans can explore what happened in their imagination. I mean, you know, when you see a great new movie franchise or whatever, or a great big story start, and you just hang out with your friends afterwards and just talk about it and what everything means, it's so much fun exploring it in your heads, away from the official continuity and the official explanations. And it's good to leave space like that.
Yeah, and that opens the door to things like fan fiction, which explores the universe even further. We were talking a couple weeks ago how Paramount and CBS has been coming down on like the Star Trek stuff. Yeah. But a lot of what they're interested in is not pushing the universe of Captain Kirk or Captain Picard, but of telling these little side stories that a mainstream audience wouldn't care about. Like, what was a Klingon Civil War like? You know, when did the Romulans invade Cardassia? And these things that are not part of the emotional stakes of the characters you're following.
Yeah. If you try to imagine what, like, the George Lucas Star Wars universe would have been like if George Lucas hadn't owned the copyright for, you know, all these, like, 20, 30 years or something like that, where if somebody came out with something like, you know, the Trooper, all these parody films like Troopers and stuff like that, and if he'd cracked down on these people, the fan community would be a fraction, literally a fraction, like a fifth the size it is right now.
Right.
But there's all these people who, as passionate as you get, you can keep on investing in the Star Wars universe. You can, there's an official explanation for everything, and then there's a new official explanation. and you can play with the old explanation or the new explanation, and you can just keep getting deeper and deeper, or you can enjoy it if you don't care at all, and you just like seeing things blow up on a screen.
Yeah, and that's the thing that keeps a franchise alive when franchises go dark, like Star Wars was gone for 17 years, or Doctor Who was off the air through the 90s, or Indiana Jones. There was an 18-year break between the third and the fourth film, but people still care enough about it. And if you don't have anything out there, it eventually just fades away and dies.
Yeah. And this, it's kind of an important principle inside of wider fandom, but it also works inside of a specific fandom like, say, Batman or Star Wars, where you need to leave space so people can enjoy their version of what they love. They can geek out over the things they love, and don't crap on people for loving something that you don't love.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a good point, is we always kind of, it seems, and maybe it seems more from just being in the store a lot, there's a lot of, you like this, so that means you hate that, you know, so it's a lot of, I read Marvel, so DC sucks, or I read DC, so Marvel sucks, and it's a big divide in the stores. All the stores I've worked in, and kind of all the stores we currently run right now, is that there's DC guys and there's Marvel guys. There's more division than guys that are reading both companies.
Yeah, I feel like where comics started was like a lot of kids who didn't get into sports, and now it's much more mainstream than it was. But I feel like that's where you put that competition mentality. And to be fair, most superhero comics are about this character versus this character, so that's right. That DNA is kind of bred in. But everybody kind of wants to pick their team, and part of building your team up is knocking the other team down. And we're saying this after two national conventions.
Right.
Well, one of my friends is editor at DC named Jim Chadwick. I've never actually worked with him, but he's a friend of mine because it's easy to talk to him because he has this very broad view on what makes a good, what it means to be a good geek. And he edits both the Injustice comic book, featuring all these incredibly dark, murderous versions of the DC heroes.
Yeah.
And he's also the guy behind things like Batman 66.
Oh, wow.
And he's perfectly comfortable doing both because he loves both versions, and he's comfortable talking to fans who love either version.
Yeah, I think that's actually really interesting, because those are probably the two extreme opposite ends of the spectrum,
right,
of as far as like superhero publishing books DC's doing. You've got a super kid friendly goofy book like Batman 66, and I've been reading Injustice since it's been coming out, and at this point it's an ongoing. They're all mini series. It's like year one, year two, year three, but it never doesn't come out monthly. And it's like, well, technically that's my favorite DC book because I've been reading it monthly for 5 years. There's no other DC book I've stuck with that.
And that's interesting because it's based on a video game with no story. Basically the Mortal Kombat version of the DC.
Yeah, I think the video game had a bit of a story, but this book is kind of taking the concept of that game was a gimmick to get the characters to fight. And this book, over 5 or 6 years at this point, is run with that football of, all right, well, what does this world really look like? How do you tell stories? Actually, twice a month, I think that book comes out sometimes, and keep it interesting. And like I said, it's the only DC book I've read monthly for the last 5 years. Wow. I've given up on Snyder's Batman. I've walked away from Justice League. I gave up on Aquaman. I've come and gone to a lot of these books, and I'm reading a lot of the Rebirth stuff, but that's the one book where it's every time it comes out, I read it.
Yeah, and Batman 66 was the polar opposite. I love that series. When it was done, I wasn't sad. I was like, oh, that was nice. We've wrapped that up. But I loved they put it back. They made it the sitcom it was.
Yeah.
Of, you know.
And they've told new stories within the same like vein. Like they really, the writers and the artists on the book really did hit like Michael Allred's covers. Were perfect.
Well, you could tell
Parker, I think, was writing a lot of it.
Yeah.
He nailed the, everything just seemed so authentic.
Well, you could see the love for that show. Nobody was making fun of it. You know, nobody was looking down on it. And it really felt like through that whole entire run, nobody was just taking it because it was an assignment that was open.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just going to put out the most obvious thing there. You could make it, take the subtext text and just, you know, kind of have Batman and Robin kind of doing knowing, loving glances toward each other. But it's so much funnier if they don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's still there. It's just subtext and it's funnier.
Well, it was homage more than parody. Yeah. It's like, let's make him sound exactly like Adam West.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things I loved as a fan was was when they would be like, what's Clayface like on the Adam West show? What's Harley Quinn look like? What's Killer Croc look like?
They took it very seriously, and they pushed it in ways you couldn't afford to do on TV.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's what's the thing I enjoyed the most about that book was their interpretation of like, all right, if we were going to do Clayface, what does the Batman 66 version of Clayface look like? What if Bane showed up? What would Bane look like? And that creative spin to work in that same sandbox of Batman 66, and it's kind of led to Wonder Woman 77, I think, got her own one shot. She's going to get a miniseries.
There was a pitch. Comic Book Resources just posted. There was a pitch for Batman 89.
I saw it. It looked really cool.
It looked beautiful.
But I think it's something where I'm given enough time. It's something where it's like Batman 66, I think, did really well. The trades do really well. The hardcovers we sell. We were selling it monthly in both the kids and the main section. And I'd say give it time. They'll do a Flash 92 or whatever that show was 90. On.
The problem with the Batman 89 thing is that the licensing back from the movie studios for that property is just a contractual nightmare.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
they would do it in the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
If the lawyers at the movie studios were interested in that little money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because, like, how long did the licensing for the Batman 66 hold up toys or Blu-rays and all the stuff?
Right.
All the merchandising we've seen.
But once it was resolved, it was a torrent.
Oh, everything. I mean, the action figures, you've got the Batmobile here in the office. It's like.
But that's interesting that the 89 is such an issue because that was made at a time when Warner Brothers owned DC and Warner Brothers still owns DC, whereas the 66 was produced by 20th Century Fox.
Warner Brothers is getting better about this, but Warner Brothers divisions do not play nice with each other. They are not good. You know, it's a kindergarten where people are throwing toys.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Well, I'm wondering if Geoff Johns' promotion, which was announced this week, is going to grease any wheels. So
I'm confused about this. Was Geoff Johns, did he get Dan Dito's job?
No.
No.
He's actually if you look at a little chart showing the hierarchy at DC Comics, he's in exactly the same position he was in before the promotion.
Okay.
But the thing is, it's like, he's now the president of DC Entertainment.
Okay.
And his direct superior, Diane Nelson, is the president of DC Comics or DC Entertainment.
Oh, okay.
There are two. There are two presidents. Yeah, it's like Knights of the Round Table.
Yeah.
But it seems like for the movies, he's now Kevin Feige at DC.
He's definitely been given more power, but he has not been given power over more people. It's just that he's been. It's been announced to everyone. Yeah, respect him more.
Yeah,
if he says something,
it carries more weight.
It carries more weight.
He has a louder voice in the room
than
he did before.
Yeah,
which is good because, as I said, the movies are what needs the most work. He's had a hand in the TV shows, which are running well, you know, and it's the movies that kind of need that turnaround.
Yeah.
So it seems like a lot of this is still fallout from Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, I mean, that Wonder Woman trailer looked phenomenal, so
it did.
I'm ready to go.
The Justice League trailer looked better. Suicide Squad looks promising. I mean, you know, DC wants to be Marvel.
Yeah, well, and I don't necessarily think they need to be Marvel. I think there's enough room for them to kind of forge, like, their own path, or like the cheesy way to say it. But I do think they can do that and stand on their own and be their own thing. I just think all I'd like is them to just be quality. You know, it's like, just make good movies. Right. Don't worry about trying to copy Marvel, do what Marvel's doing. Just make good films.
They want to create something where they can build, you know, they want one of those franchises where they can build one property off another property.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, in a way, they also want to be Star Wars.
Yeah. And I think that these aren't bad models to follow, but I think it's something where I think they really do just need to show a lot more faith in their characters. You know, they don't have really a lot of faith in Superman, it seems, where, you know, we all know, well, not all of us, obviously, but I think the general consensus is that Superman shouldn't be more like Batman. That doesn't really work for his character. Because if he is, then you do get a version of Superman like Injustice, where it's like, well, he's now a dictator because he could just take over the world if he thought like Batman. He could police everybody.
Well, I saw a video recently on YouTube that had been shared around a lot from somebody called the Nerd Writer, where it was called The Fundamental Flaw of Batman versus Superman. And I watch it, and it did a really great interpretation of what is the great flaw of Batman versus Superman. It's like they built up scenes, but they didn't earn the emotional punch at the end, you know, inside the scenes, where it's like they have this grand, beautiful scene of, you know, Superman dying and blah, 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 or over and over again, the vision of, you know, a dream sequence or, you know, Bruce Wayne's parents being killed again and again.
Yeah.
And it was like, I watched it, and it was like, they made some excellent points inside that video. The problem is, even if they fixed all of that, there are other flaws. There is no single fundamental flaw to Batman versus Superman.
Right.
There are many.
Well, I just watched that Ultimate Edition that's on Blu-ray, and they fix a few things because there were a lot of things in the theatrical version that just don't make any sense. Yeah. And there's a line of dialogue here, or there's a scene here that connect them together, but it doesn't delete anything that was bad. It didn't make it a good film.
Yeah, and I think we've made the comparison to like the Daredevil director's cut with Ben Affleck, is that it has some things that fill in some of the plot holes.
Right.
But there's still a lot of plot holes, and there's still so many things. There's a good movie in there somewhere. You can half an hour edit down that movie into a real quick action-y film.
But it's not something like, say, Superman Returns, I always thought would be a great film if you cut 45 minutes out of it. There was a cut of the three Hobbit films made into 1 4-hour film. That's fantastic.
Oh, and it's
just the book.
It's the Tolkien cut,
yeah,
right? Where it's everything that had nothing to do with the book was cut out.
Right, but you can see that film, but in those cuts, you could see there's a great film in there that was shot well and written well. In things like Batman vs. Superman or Daredevil, what is in there was substandard.
Though I'll say there are also fundamental flaws, I believe, with Superman Returns, where at its heart, there's some really great emotional stuff. But the story structure of just like who's the protagonist, antagonist, what is their conflict, was so flawed. And just the whole thing of like, and the solution is he lifted a giant rock for 3 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
And then he lifted it higher. And then he lifted it higher. And then he died. And it's just like, yeah, you're not understanding the basic concept of adventure action movies.
No, he was doing a lot of lifting. He lifted a boat. He lowered a plane.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like catching the plane. That's a great scene, I think. Yeah. There's a lot of emotional
punch. When he lands on the pitcher's mound is a beautiful shot.
I think it was really, really well filmed. But I think you're right. It's like the big ultimate thing that Superman does. He lifts a continent and he puts it into space and then dies. And it's like
what you're saying about the essence of the character. I was just watching this morning. I was watching Star Trek Into Darkness again because I'm going to go see Beyond and I haven't seen it yet. And it made me realize, it's not a good film. And it made me realize that J.J. Abrams didn't understand the essence of those characters the way he understood the essence of Star Wars. Because the next film he makes is Star Wars Force Awakens, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, and even his first Star Trek is pretty good. But once he had to do more with those characters, he had run out of things he liked about them.
Well, yeah, one way to put it is that he was trying to turn Star Trek into a Star Wars story. And he kept on twisting it out of shape.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And Star Trek villains are not Star Wars villains. They act very differently. They use very different logic. And it's a much bigger, different space where you can't just be the Jedi. You know, you can't. There are no Sith inside of Star Trek. You can't have an uber villain like that where they just, by virtue of being evil, they're powerful.
Right, because they're all about current politics. When you run into the Klingons or the Cardassians, there are analogs to Russia and Nazi Germany. They're not a supervillain type of engine.
Yeah, and when they try to turn Khan into a Sith, and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so... Oh my God, we're pretty much out of time.
That's what geeks do.
Yeah, that's right.
This is pretty much, we're geeks with microphones. So we've got an edge on
you. We have a platform.
On some other geeks. Go get yourself some microphones. We'll all be on equal footing.
Right.
But May, how do we get May?
Please go to your local comic shop. And if they have an internet connection, they should be able to look it up really quickly from Dark Horse. The other way is... if you live in some benighted part of the world where you can't get to a comic shop, you can buy it directly through the Dark Horse app as a digital comic. You can't snort it then, though. You can't pick up the comic book and snort the edge of it.
It's not a physical thing you can hold.
Yeah. Is that why you got into comics? Is it some sort of cocaine addiction that you have?
You know it's true.
Right. And how can we follow you online?
If you see the title of this episode, you'll see my name, Gene Ha, and just add a .com to the end. No spaces, no dashes, just GeneHa.com.
That's great. And you can follow me at Not On My Book on Twitter. That is the Captivated Comics Twitter feed. You can follow our Facebook page, is where we post all the latest news and obviously pictures of people that have been on the show and the latest episodes. And you can listen to us, subscribe through iTunes, subscribe through Stitcher, or listen to every episode we've done in the last 3.5 years on caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. And Steven?
Go ahead. This is really important. Yeah. If you want to get May and you have a lot of bonus miles from your airline, fly to O'Hare Airport and then go to LaGrange, Illinois.
Oh, right.
And go to Chimera's Comics and buy the copies there.
Yes, we do have them in stock at 19 South LaGrange Road.
It is the most efficient usage of your airline miles possible. Right.
I love that you've been doing this plug for 3.5 years, and Gene Ha completely did it better
than me. Did a better plug than me in one episode, yeah.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that, meatball!